Pod Awful Channel. Pod Awful.
Bi-quarterly Women's Social Club.
Dazed and Convicted.
Pool Party Radio.
Show Kane.
The Devil's Advocate.
The Projection Booth.
Awful Flips.
Pod Awful.
Net.
I have control of your TV set. Are you receiving me?
There was once in Venice a Moor, Othello, who for his merits in the affairs of war was held in great esteem. It happened that he fell in love with a young and noble lady called Desdemona, who, drawn by his virtue, became equally enamored of him.
I'll poison his delight.
Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy.
Look to your wife.
Dost thou in conscience think that there be women to abuse their husbands of such gross kind? Wouldst thou do such a deed for all the world?
Why, would not you?
No, by this heavenly light.
I might do it as well in the dark.
A sweet woman.
I'll chop her into masses. Call me.
Is he not light of brain?
He is that he is.
Othello.
Hi, Desdemona.
Will you come to bed, my lord?
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Well, it's more about the Moors.
Also here for the fun is Mr. Joseph McBride.
Hi, Rob and Mike. How are you doing? Good to be on the show.
Glad to have you back aboard, sir. This week we are discussing the 1952 film Othello, based upon William Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Othello, Moor of Venice. The film was directed by and stars Orson Welles. Shot over a period of 4 years, the making of Othello sometimes overshadows the film itself, which is kind of a triumph of will, a conquering of resources and circumstances. The film was the co-winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes and a highly unusual adaptation of Shakespeare in its day. Joseph, as our guest, I want to ask you, when was the first time you saw Othello, and what did you think?
I saw it a long time ago in Wisconsin. I was a student at the University of Wisconsin when I wrote my first of my three books on Welles, and I got hooked on Welles with Kane, but then they had a series of his other films, and I realized he made many extraordinary films, some of which are, you know, in the same league as Kane. And so I saw Othello way back in the 60s. You know, I've still never seen the 1952 version, strangely enough, which is not available in this country. I saw the opening of it recently. Somebody showed me that. But the 1955 version was the American release. It took that long to get it released in America, and Welles had re-edited the film by that time. Even that version is very hard to see now because it was pulled off the market because Welles' youngest daughter, Beatrice, owns the film, and she did this restoration in 1992. And the word restoration needs to be in quotation marks because she and producer Michael Dawson did a lot of tampering with the soundtrack and some other alterations that were unfortunate.
So how about you, Rob? When did you first see the Welles Othello?
I don't believe I saw it before watching it for the show, which I'm not sure why I hadn't seen it. I think it was a matter of I knew that there were several different versions floating around, and this is a discussion we've often had on this show, where when we know there's several different versions floating around, it's like, well, which one should I really watch? Because I don't want to watch six different versions of the film. But seeing it for the first time this past week, at least if my memory serves, it was quite a revelation for me to see it, because there's a lot of things in here that I think echo back to his work earlier than you know, when this was released in the mid-50s.
Did you see the so-called restored version, or which did you watch?
Yeah, I think it was the 92 version.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I mean, for example, there was a great musical score in the original. Francesco Lavagnino did this beautiful score, and Welles had, for example, 40 mandolins playing in one scene.
Get you to bed. Dismiss your attendant there. Look, it be done.
Thank you.
get you to bed. Dismiss your attendant there. Look at Bidon.
They re-recorded the score, and they were cheap, and they only used 7 mandolins, and so it doesn't have the same richness as the original, and they also redid a lot of the sound effects. So you haven't actually seen Wells's version, but the 1955 version I consider the truest version, but again, he tampered with it. It actually, I found out, it came out in 1951 in Italy first in a dubbed version that he didn't supervise. This was revealed in the book Wells in Italy that came out recently. And then he re-edited parts of it for his film, Filming Othello, in the 70s. So it's one of those, sometimes with literature, there are many versions of different things. And Shakespeare, actually, when you think about it, his plays exist in different versions. The quartos and the folios are often different, and people edit them together and combine them in different ways, and that's sometimes controversial.
I totally agree with you, Rob, as far as the I didn't know which version I was watching or what to watch when it came to this. I wasn't aware of all the different versions of Othello when it came to this one. I have never watched his Don Quixote just because I've heard that there are different versions floating around, and the one that was put together by, was it Joe D'Amato? Did he put that together?
It was Franco. That's a horrible film that should be avoided. It's this travesty of... they took some bad work print footage, and he combined it with a documentary Wells made for Italian television where he's traveling around Spain. It's a real travesty, but I've seen about 40 minutes of really good quality footage from Don Quixote at an archive, and it's a totally different experience. But I should mention that the reason the 1955 Wells version is not available, Criterion put it on a Laserdisc, and Beatrice Wells objected. She owns Othello. It's the only Wells film that she actually owns, because Wells retained ownership of it and then left it to his wife, who then died, and then she left it to Beatrice. So Beatrice blocked the 1955 version. If you go on eBay and you can find the Criterion Laserdisc, you could watch it, but that's about the only way to watch it right now.
Well, just between you, me, and the listeners, it's out on YouTube right now. So,
FYI. YouTube is amazing what turns up. Huh? But the 92 version, I should say, I've seen the Carlotta version, which is the new French DVD and Blu-ray, which I did a 45-minute interview on the film with Robert Fisher did the interview with me, and it's going to be on the DVD, which is coming out November 5th, I believe, in France. And it's with Macbeth. And I have to say, the picture quality is really beautiful on the DVD Blu-ray. I'm not sure if they've done anything to enhance it, but it looks really sharp and really beautifully photographed. But the soundtrack is the same. It still has the problems that I mentioned from the 92 version. One of the conditions I made when they asked me to do the interview is I said I want to be able to criticize the what they did to the sound, and they said, sure, okay, because Robert Fisher is a good filmmaker, and he wanted to, do an honest interview, whether people agree with me or not, But that version is not scheduled for release in America yet, so if you want to get it, you'll have to have an all-region player and order it from France.
So like you, Rob, I was very taken aback when I first saw this film, which was for this show. I was completely blown away. The use of the black and white was gorgeous. The film opens basically with the end of the play. It ends with Desdemona and Othello, our main character, dead. And it's a little Citizen Kane-esque, because then we have to figure out why are these two people dead, what happened, and who is this guy who's being kind of hoisted up into this cage in the air? Why do we know these characters? Who are they? What are we? How did they get into this situation? And we open up with this funeral, which is just absolutely gorgeous the way that they shoot this. Like, so many of the characters are in silhouette, these priests and different mourners who are taking the bodies away. And at times we have these multiple levels of these mourners in procession, one with the Desdemona's corpse, one with Othello's corpse. It's nice that the movie starts with Othello already dead, starts basically with his head, and we kind of go up from there. And then we don't see the living Othello until, like, at least about 9 minutes into the film. And until then, it's everybody talking about Othello, especially this guy Iago, who we meet pretty much at the beginning. He's the guy who's being foisted up into that cage. And so you pretty much know, okay, this guy is going to be trouble, and we immediately find out that he is. It's him and a buddy of his, Roderigo, who's played by Robert Coote, and who pretty much is voiced completely by Orson Welles, if I'm hearing correctly, because it didn't sound like his voice.
Yeah, that was Welles. He did that. Yeah, and he did some other voices, but he did all of Roderigo, or almost all of them, yeah.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny to see Welles' voice coming out of this guy's mouth. Though, to your point, Joseph, as far as the sound, I mean, there were major problems that I had with the sound right off the bat. It was like, as we see Othello and Desdemona being led away, and there, you know, we have this funeral procession, the music just feels like it's way too, like, in front of the image for me. It felt like it was a silent film that was being scored after the fact, which kind of it was rescored after the fact. So it was just this weird, like, here's this chunk of music that's in the way, and it didn't integrate with the film very well at all to me.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a problem when you see the Welles version. I mean, his the music is really beautiful, and it is a silent sequence, pretty much. You hear some monks chanting, which was changed, actually. Their chants in Latin were changed for the 92 version, actually removed. They removed the chants. The music is thinner than in the original. As I said, it's more lush in the original, but that happens in some Welles films where the images play with music, and it is like a silent film. I think what you might be reacting to is the modernity of the sound recording. Some, you can tell sometimes with sound effects that they sound too modern. And also they've changed, like in the opening sequence when they're dragging Iago into the cage, you hear the footsteps and then the clanking of the chain and all that, and it sounds more heightened than it did in the original. They hyped it up a bit, which is noticeable if you've seen the original. But it is a stunning opening for the film. And Welles, as you mentioned with Citizen Kane, he did this in a number of films. He often starts with the main character dead and then shows how the person got that way. And it's a way of showing fate. You know, it's like, okay, this person is doomed from the beginning. And then, as you say, he doesn't appear for a while, and then he makes a kind of spectacular entrance, and he gives the famous speech to the Senate, which Welles does very well, where he's explaining how he wooed and won Desdemona. It's one of the most beautiful speeches in Shakespeare. But I have a problem with the sound anyway, and it bothers me a lot. The dialogue is often kind of muffled. Did you find that to be true?
I definitely found that to be true, yeah.
Yeah, kind of hard to hear sometimes. And you know, it's a real problem, especially with Shakespeare, where you want to hear the words. And then, I mean, part of it is that he does a lot of editing. It's a very highly edited film, and sometimes the line will be broken up, like some famous line will be heard, like, in the distance, and it'll be interrupted by a cut. Those kind of things are aesthetic choices, but there was something wrong with either the sound recording or the re-recording. A lot of it was dubbed by Welles. You know, a lot of it was shot silent or redubbed, and Suzanne Cloutier, who plays Desdemona, had her whole voice redubbed by Gudrun Ewer, who is an actress who Welles had played Desdemona on the stage right after he did the film, and then he preferred her voice. But there's something funny about the sound, and it always bothers me and makes this less than one of my favorite Welles films, because it's a struggle to hear the dialogue. I must say, in the French version that's coming out, the dialogue is a little clearer than before, so they've done some things. You can do things with modern sound re-recording to make dialogue more audible, which I think is fine. One scene, for example, where they have three lines of dialogue that they just made up, in 1992, and they had some new actors dubbed the lines that weren't in the 1955 version at all. And they also, to make some lines sync properly, they cut off parts of lines or condense them or change the speed and things like that, which I think is really unforgivable. You shouldn't tamper with the film. I'd rather have a film be out of sync a little bit than start messing with the dialogue. And Wells, in my opinion, would always sacrifice synchronization for a line reading. There are a lot of his films where sometimes you see Othello, and this happens in other films too, like The Trial, where somebody's mouth is closed and dialogue is coming out. And that bothers people a lot in America because we're hung up on technical perfection. But in Europe, it's not as big a deal. And in Italy, in that era, every film was dubbed, you know. Wells freely tampered with the soundtracks in the post-production. Like, he did 11 voices in The Trial, for example, and he was a radio guy from the beginning, and so the soundtrack was like a separate toy to play with aesthetically, where he would do all kinds of stuff with it. So I think you should just leave his soundtracks alone. And Chimes of Midnight, which I think is his greatest film, another Shakespeare film, which has barely been seen in the U.S., they're threatening to restore that as well. And Michael Dawson, the same producer, has been working on that. I saw him a few months ago for the first time, and he said he felt regretful for what they did to Othello. He thought they were wrong. But they're trying to sync up parts of Chimes of Midnight, which I wish they wouldn't do. And, you know, once you start doing that, too, what else are you going to do to the film? I don't know what they're going to do.
Next up, Jar Jar as Iago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like George Lucas does that with all his films, doesn't he? And somebody made a blog recently about how you can't see the original Star Wars anymore because he's tampered with it so much that he won't let people look at it, you know? And that's kind of removing part of history when you can't see an original of something. And he says, well, it's my film, I can do what I want, and the technique's advanced, blah, 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 blah. But, I mean, we want to see it as it was when it first came out and caused this big sensation, you know?
Well, the one thing for me in this, when I was watching it, I mean, beyond the fact that it's, you know, Orson Welles, is it looks, like you were saying, Mike, with the shadows and the black and white and everything, it has a really nice look to it, and that's what I think reminded me of his work as well. And, you know, the thing with the restoration and the various cuts of this and everything, I hate to say it, that has become sort of the standard issue when it comes to Orson Welles. I mean, kind of like Beyond Kane and F for Fake, it seems like everything else has had right. multiple versions, has been taken away from him, was cut, you know, by some dude and wherever who didn't know anything. And it becomes such a it becomes such an annoyance, and it becomes such a, you know, sort of a dismantling and disrespecting of someone's work. And it really is troublesome to someone like me who would just go, look, just leave it. Just give us what he did and just stop messing with it.
Yeah, my feeling, you know, listening to our conversation, I was just sort of thinking of somebody listening in that maybe we're focusing so much on this that the film is getting lost, that the film has a lot of powerful qualities, like you mentioned, the great photography and other things we can talk about. But it is, you're not seeing the actual film that Welles made, for better or worse. And that is true, what you say about his career. Almost every other film was tampered with. There were a couple that were not, but, you know, there are many versions, which creates a lot of problems for scholars and actually a lot of work for scholars. And also, I mean, I kind of think that Welles left some of his films unfinished so that we'd still be working on them today and talking about them. His career is still going on. But he had a lot of problems because he was a maverick filmmaker. He, you know, Othello was made mostly with his own money, and then he had to get investors, and he would go off and act in a film and then come back and put that money into the film. But it was a handmade film over 4 years, and nobody was doing that at the time. He was, you know, an independent filmmaker before that term really existed. And so the film had a lot of problems with continuity and ragged production values, and that it looks as good as it does is remarkable. But he did amazing things. Somebody will slap somebody in one country, and then the reverse shot will be 1,100 miles away 6 months later, you know, and it all works. And he kept it all in his head. He didn't have a continuity person or anything. And it's quite an achievement visually. It tells the story with poetic visuals more than dialogue to some extent. So the complaints about the dialogue sometimes are a little beside the point because it is more of a visual experience than auditory. He cut a lot of dialogue from the play. There's a long scene in which Iago poisons Othello's mind against his wife and convinces him that his wife is unfaithful. And it's always difficult to play that in the theater because you take a guy who loves his wife and in the course of one scene that's several hundred lines, you totally turn him against his wife to the point where he wants to kill her, which is quite a remarkable psychological change. And Wells cut that way down, but he filmed it all in one take because he wanted it to be a very intense two-shot where Iago is talking to him and he's reacting. But he couldn't do it as long as it plays on the stage. But it's very powerful the way it's shot with that long take. That's like the only long take in the film. Wells, he's famous for long takes in his Hollywood films and some of the other films. But with Othello, he didn't have the resources of cranes and tracking shots. So it's a very highly montage-driven film.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the plot. I was very surprised watching this. How simple the plot is. I'm used to there being a lot more stuff going on. I mean, especially we talked about Titus a few weeks ago, and that was very intricate, a whole bunch of different plots going on, all of these things weaving around in here. And there's some weaving going on in Othello, but really it's this whole idea of Iago wanting to destroy Othello. And that's the biggest through line that we have with the film, and he does all of these different things in order to make that happen. There's his poisoning of Othello with his words. There's him using other people as his pawns, kind of to try to take this guy down. He's trying to move people around politically and everything. A lot of it kind of, I won't say it blows up in his face, but it doesn't seem to work. Sometimes Othello just kind of comes out smelling like roses. Like the whole movie begins with Iago going with Rodrigo to Desdemona's father and saying, hey, just so you know, your daughter has snuck away with this Moor and they're making the beast with the two backs and everything. You should really get on this. You know, you're the laughing stock of town, basically. And then it becomes this whole like, oh, geez, you know, I got to go get this Othello guy. What's going on? Though they don't really say his name very much at all. I notice until he actually is in the movie. Until then, it's more like he and him and the Moor and all this kind of stuff. It isn't until he's right there that he actually seems to gain his name, which also is kind of that nice, you know, his presence finally coming into the film as a living being and everything. But yeah, for me, it was, I won't say it was simplistic, but there was definitely just pretty much one major thing going on. I don't know if you guys agree with that or not.
Wells did a film called Filming Othello in 1978, which is one of his essay films where he talks about the film and he gives some thoughts on it. And he has a fascinating interview where he's sitting with Michael McLeamore, who plays Iago, and Hilton Edwards, who plays Brabantio, the father of Desdemona. And McLeamore and Edwards were partners in life as well as in the Gate Theater in Dublin, and they helped discover Orson Welles. So they're really old friends and great experts on Shakespeare. And they have a long talk about what the play is about, what the motives might be. And Edwards says, you know, it's actually very simple. It's just about jealousy. It is about what it seems to be about. It doesn't have some hidden subtext like some plays you have to figure out it's really about this or that. It appears to be about jealousy, and he says he's firmly convinced that's exactly what it's about. But the big debate, and this has gone on for, you know, hundreds of years, is what motivates Iago. That's a real mystery because it's complex and the play doesn't give you a clear answer, and that's what makes him so interesting. Coleridge called Iago an example of motiveless malignancy, which is a great phrase. Wells quotes that in the documentary, and what Wells told McLeamore was he said to play him as if he were sexually impotent, and that would be the motive for his jealousy of this very virile Moor. And the fact that he cast an openly gay actor who was very flamboyantly gay, too. I think he doesn't come off necessarily as gay in the film, but the sexual tensions are very strong in the film. And also you have the black man and a white woman, which, you know, today it's more accepted, but back then was a major taboo. And Welles could not have made Othello in America. As a matter of fact, the Breen office objected to Othello, and that's one reason it took a while to come out in America. You know, he could barely get away with it because it was based on Shakespeare. But, you know, when you come right down to it, it's a very transgressive film for 1952. And, you know, it's about that to some extent that Othello is very respected in Venice because he's a great military leader and all that. But there is this racial and sexual animosity going on that the play is partly about as well. And so, I mean, it's simple in some ways and complex in some other ways.
Iago really is one of, you know, I would say the top three villains in Shakespeare, and we've talked about two so far during this month. One is Aaron the Moor from Titus, and the second being Richard III, and probably I'd put Richard higher up in terms of name recognition for most people, and then probably Iago, and then Aaron in terms of what people remember, because you see Othello more than you see Titus Andronicus. But he really is sort of this rotter character, and it's kind of interesting because I think that his pathology lays somewhere between jealousy and envy.
And they're related too, aren't they? Jealousy and envy are related. You're envious of somebody's virility, and therefore you're jealous. And you know, what triggers the whole drama is Othello gets married to Desdemona, and that sets off Iago's campaign of hatred against he's going to destroy this marriage. Also, I mean, there are other things going on. For example, I believe strongly that Welles was blacklisted, and not everybody agrees with me, but he left America in early November 1947, which was right after the HUAC hearings, where they started investigating the Hollywood 10, and the blacklist was beginning that month, and Welles fled to Europe and didn't come back to live until the blacklist was starting to erode around 1956. And I think the film reflects that. It's partly about, literally, you know, black person who's an outsider who's stigmatized and destroyed. And Welles is, an outsider living in Europe. And he was also being attacked a lot in Italy. There's a book called Welles in Italy that came out recently, and I didn't realize how hostile the Italian press was to him. They didn't like Citizen Kane. They thought it was a decadent, Baroque, Hollywood, egomaniacal film. Italian neorealism was the fashion, and he's the opposite of that. So he was getting pilloried in the press, and so there's some personal resonances you could draw with the character on those levels, I think, too, between Welles and Othello. He identifies with him. Well, in the documentary filming Othello, Welles and Edwards talk about how we all have somebody in our life who's an Iago, and I think Welles says we're lucky if we only have one, you know, somebody who's out to tear us down out of jealousy or whatever. And often the cause of that is sort of obscure or forgotten. And I think the prototype in Welles's life is John Houseman, who was his partner in the Mercury Theater, and then they had a falling out, and Houseman spent the rest of his life belittling Welles and spreading bad stories about him and trying to damage his reputation. And Welles was bedeviled by Houseman. There were people before that in Welles's life who betrayed him, and I think he was constantly, that was one of his greatest anxieties, was betrayal. And I knew him well enough, and I've read a lot about him and everything, so I know that one of the things he did was he was so worried about his friends betraying him that he would push his friends and colleagues very hard to test their loyalty. And then inevitably, they would all let him down in some way, and then he would say, see, this guy betrayed me, you know. It's like he created the situation that he feared the most. And so I think it's a very personal film on that level as well.
I think some of the challenges that Welles had when it came to the filming of this, and we'll definitely get into this more in the second half of the show, but he had so many problems when it came to the budget and all of this stuff, and that it turned into this 4-year project. He shot it in a very smart way, and the problems that he had didn't necessarily turn into advantages all of the time, but they definitely turned into some opportunities for him to use filmmaking in different ways. You had mentioned, Joseph, the whole idea of, you know, throwing a punch in one country and landing in another country. The whole idea of the close-ups and how often we see these characters in these close-ups. A lot of times we get these people shot from underneath, so they have the clear sky above them or just nondescript buildings above them. That whole idea of this underneath, especially for Iago, kind of showing him in power that way, him looming over the camera, I think that was very smart, because then you don't necessarily know where you're at. We're not seeing, you know, a long shot. We're not seeing even a medium shot a lot of times. We just have these close-ups. A lot of times I was reminded of some of the earlier, going back to silent films, reminded especially of The Passion of Joan of Arc, just with those close-ups and that cutting style that he used. He was especially using that in the filming Othello. I could see, I mean, some of those cuts were absolutely crazy in what he was doing with that, you know, but it really reminded me of Dreyer and the way that we were so focused on Joan of Arc and on those angry faces that were there with the trial and everything. So I thought that he did a really good job when it came to that. That's not to say, though, that the film is all close-ups. There are some really gorgeous long shots and some gorgeous scenery and everything. And one of the things that I really liked that he did was this whole idea of the netting and the putting people, I mean, I talked about putting Iago in a cage, that we have so many people caged, quote unquote, by the various things that we have going on in front of them. There are a lot of nets going on. There's a lot of grating going on. I mean, one of the final scenes that we have with Othello, there's these, you know, hash marks across him where he's being shot through this kind of cage and everything. So I love this whole idea of trying to trap people. And it kind of speaks to me, that whole line of, you know, with as little a web as this, I will ensnare as great a fly as Cassio, that Iago says. And that's what he's trying to do. He is trying to be this kind of puppet master spider in the middle of the spider web and trying to, you know, manipulate everything so that he can ensnare the people. And it is interesting that he does play on the jealousy when it comes to, well, of course, when it comes to Othello, but trying to kind of maneuver people who maybe wanted Desdemona more, you know, they think that they wanted her more than Othello, or they're jealous of Othello for getting Desdemona. But yeah, Iago, if memory, I mean, as far as I know with the relationships, he's already got a woman, so he really shouldn't be jealous of Desdemona and everything, but he is just so jealous of Othello that it just drives him crazy. And I love this whole idea of him trying to ensnare everyone in this web that he's crafting.
He does have a wife, played by Faye Compton, who is a famous English stage actress, who was the original Mary Rose on stage in the James M. Barry play. And she's very bitter and angry in the film. You can tell their marriage is not good. And if he's sexually impotent, that would explain some of it. But she turns against Iago and becomes an ally of Desdemona because she realizes what he's doing. And he winds up killing his wife. And that's an interesting subplot in the film. But when you talk about the entrapment and the caging and the visual metaphors of that, that goes to the heart of Welles' work, which is kind of a tension between power and entrapment. If you look at his films, that Citizen Kane, just to take one, is about this very powerful man who, you know, seems to have a lot of control over people in the world. And as the film goes on, he gets more and more trapped in that mansion, that dark, shadowy mansion, and there are a lot of images that show entrapment, and it becomes very claustrophobic. And Othello is something like that, where there are a lot of beautiful exterior scenes to kind of show the buoyancy of Othello as a great military man of the world. But as it goes on, it gets darker and more claustrophobic, and he's kind of trapped in this. And there's an underground cistern, which is very creepy, and there shadowy rooms and as you say, shadows over his face, and it's very brilliantly shot, and that's a big metaphor for all kinds of things, that he's, you know, he's not as powerful as he seems, and he throws it all away. There's a great line in the play when he gives his final speech before he kills himself. He refers to him as one whose hand, like the base Indian, threw a pearl away richer than all his tribe, which is a wonderful line. It's got some of the most beautiful verse in Shakespeare, and that's one of the contradictions of the film, is that Wells throws out a lot of the beautiful verse and relies on the camera. He's coming for some criticism. Eric Bentley wrote a famous review where he said of Wells' performance, he says, he never acts, he is photographed. And Wells had to admit that's actually true. I think Wells' performance is not particularly good as Othello. It suffers, I think, from the fact that, you know, he had to direct the film, which is a hard thing to do when you're acting, but with all the technical problems and logistical and economic problems, I think his performance was the last thing on his mind. And there was a time once when we were shooting The Other Side of the Wind that I was in another room and I heard Wells say to somebody in a loud voice, he said, Joe would like Christopher Plummer. He said, he doesn't like my Shakespearean performances either. So I ran in the other room and I hastened to tell Wells that I thought his Falstaff was his best performance and I thought his Macbeth is excellent. But I said, I have to say, I don't think your Othello is right, because you're not right for that part, because Othello is pretty much a victim, even though he's a man of power. Wells plays men of power and who have tragic falls, but Othello is played as a kind of a dupe of Iago, and Wells is not particularly good at that. Some critics have pointed out they think that maybe Wells was too dispassionate playing the part. He didn't have the emotion and the grand gestures that he should have, because maybe he was too concerned playing a black character in blackface. Somebody said that maybe he felt embarrassed to be doing that, or he didn't want to appear to be too, quote, black, unquote, which is, it's always kind of an issue when they do Othello, especially with a white actor, you know, how black the character will be and how many African gestures and, you know, kinds of ethnic mannerisms the actor has. And Laurence Olivier did the part, you know, on stage and on film in the 60s, and he is kind of ludicrous, I have to say. His makeup is really overdone, and he's really hamming it up. Wells told me Olivier's Othello reminded him of Sammy Davis Jr., which I thought was a little much better. But I don't think Wells is really very good as Othello, to be honest. I think McLemore is superb as Iago, and Cloutier/Gudrun Ur is very good as Desdemona.
You know, in terms of the blackface in here, it doesn't seem as exaggerated as in other things that I've seen where there's blackface. It almost seems like he's more bronze Mediterranean as opposed to being black, and it didn't bother me as much as when I've seen other films. You know, you look back through the history of, you know, old Hollywood, and there's some blackface stuff in there, and we talked about that as well in Song of the South and also Bamboozled in those episodes about sort of blackface and the use of blackface.
We accept it in Othello because it's a classical role, that there's a long theatrical tradition of white people blacking up to play Othello, so it's not considered offensive, although only recently has a black actor played the role on film. Lawrence Fishburne played it in the 90s. But, you know, it is not considered offensive. But you're right that Wells' blackness is not very pronounced in the film, although he varies throughout the film. His skin color changes a lot in the film, if you've noticed. But it is rather subdued by comparison with, say, Laurence Olivier's Othello.
Yeah, he's no Al Jolson. Let's just put it out there with that. He is no Al Jolson playing this role. But yeah, I've seen pictures of Laurence Olivier doing this, and it does look a little silly. And kind of going through what I've seen when it came to Othello, I mean, it does seem to be a role where finally black actors can kind of come into their own. I mean, going through some of the list of some of the people that I've seen play Othello or that I know have played Othello, like the great Ted Lang played him. And
My mother saw Paul Robeson play Othello on the stage in the 1940s, which was a major event, especially because he had a white actress, Uta Hagen, play Desdemona. That was considered very daring at the time, and she said he was fantastic, and I can imagine he was a great actor with a tremendous presence.
I also read somewhere that there was an opposite version of Othello made with, I believe it was Patrick Stewart as Othello with an all-black cast.
That's interesting as a concept. And Wells famously did the black Macbeth, you know, the voodoo Macbeth or the Negro Macbeth had different names in 1936. One of his great triumphs as a stage director, he was only 20 years old, and he did Macbeth in Harlem with an all-black cast. And it was a tremendous success. He said the opening night of it was the greatest night of his life. And so he was always very liberal in terms of race, very supporting black actors and black Americans. And he got thrown off the radio, basically, in 1946 for defending Isaac Woodard, who was a black World War II veteran who came back to the South. And a bus driver objected to something. They called him boy, and Woodard objected to it, and a sheriff beat Woodard so badly he was blinded, and Wells passionately defended him and attacked the sheriff on the radio and was never allowed again to do radio political commentary because of that. And when you look at Touch of Evil, there's a lot of commentary about race in there. And, you know, it's a theme that has preoccupied Wells a lot in his political life as well as in his films occasionally.
It's funny, though, for every Yaphet Kotto or William Marshall who plays Othello, then you have an Anthony Hopkins playing Othello. Mm-hmm. But it seems like only recently, you're right, as far as in the last few years, it feels like black actors have finally managed to say, listen, there's enough of us around here where we can do this. You know, it's like that whole idea of like, oh, let's get this man or woman to play this transgender character. It's like, yeah, there's yeah. enough transgendered actors where we can, you know, give them a shot as well. So it's interesting that, you know, you had mentioned the Larry Fishburne performance. There was the film O that was out there, this Tim Blake Nelson film where Mekhi Phifer played him. I haven't seen the Lawrence Fishburne one. I know you have, Rob. What did you think of that
one? Yeah, I saw that in the theater when it came out. I think it was 95. And as we talked about on Richard III, there seemed to be like a whole raft of Shakespeare films that came out in the 90s, and that was one of them. And the thing that's interesting to watch, the reason to watch that one, is not only Lawrence Fishburne as Othello, but to see Kenneth Branagh as Iago, and he doesn't direct it. I can't remember off the top of my head who directed the film, but as you know, if it wasn't for Kenneth Branagh and all of his stuff that he did in the late 80s and early 90s, I think that we wouldn't have had that raft of Shakespeare films, because he showed that you could do them and make them interesting for people, and at least they would play at your local art house theater.
Yeah, Oliver Parker directed that 95 version, by the way. I think, you know, the only caveat I'd make, Mike, it's great that black actors, you know, are getting more and more chances to play Shakespeare. I saw an all-black production of Twelfth Night recently on stage here in Berkeley, which was terrific. You know, the cast was great. One thing about the stage is they have this tradition of, hopefully, you know, tradition of colorblind casting, that it shouldn't matter what race you are, you could play any part. And, you know, sometimes it's often worked to the disadvantage of black actors. But I'm not sure that Othello should be owned by white or black actors. You know, if an actor is really good, let him play the part. But I'm not sure Anthony Hopkins would be the ideal choice for the role. But Wells, I just don't think, was particularly good in the part. But Wells once said the reason he cast himself in his films was, he said, I'm the cheapest movie star I know. You know, who else could he get to be on wait for 4 years and show up whenever he wanted him to and do it for nothing, you know? So he was kind of stuck with himself in the role. He said later that he thought he should have been older when he played the part. That's another interesting consideration. He was too young for the part. But, you know, something drew him to do this film and spend 4 years of his life in exile making this film. And it was, I mean, it's a heroic achievement to finish the film. There's a marvelous book by McLemore about the making of it called Put Money in Thy Purse, which I would recommend. It's very funny, and it's a diary of the filming and a lot of insights into Wells' way of working. As somebody who's acted for Wells, I recognize a lot of the situations, and also even some of the same lines, like when we were doing Other Side of the Wind, when Wells wanted a close-up, he would say, now a big head of polla which he said was what Pola Negri, the silent movie actress, would say when she was ready for her close-up. She had a Polish accent, so he said, well, now a big head of Pola, and he would do that on Othello. And then when he was trying to make the cast happy, he would sing a song from a play he did in at the Todd School for Boys called Finesse the Queen. He would sing the title song, which would always make everybody laugh. You know, so he had certain shticks as a director that he would do, and but also the complications of keeping the cast pacified and together. It was very hard to keep people coming back and back and back, and sometimes they'd sit in a hotel for 3 weeks and Wells wouldn't be there because he'd be off shooting. Henry Hathaway, I interviewed, he directed Wells in The Black Rose, which was a ridiculous film, and Wells did it to get money for Othello. He complained to me that Wells would go off with a camera and a crew and shoot scenes for Othello while he was supposed to be acting in The Black Rose, for example. You know,
I have to say, I was really impressed with the Othello that was, the Mekhi Phifer one that I mentioned, that Tim Blake Nelson, who I didn't realize he was a director as well as an actor, he did that, and it was supposed to apparently come out in 99, but because of Columbine, they pushed it back a couple of years, which is weird because I just was listening to a conversation talking about Columbine and how that affected what movies were released and which ones weren't. And I always forget just what an effect that had. But they really play up the whole idea of the threat of the black man when it came to, you know, the play and everything. And setting it in high school was very interesting. At first I thought, oh God, this is going to be so cheesy. This is going to be like Romeo plus Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann film, which I really could not, I couldn't stomach that film. I couldn't make it a half an hour through that. But I have to say, it was really well. They start off with all of these white pigeons, and it's a voiceover from Josh Harnett, who's playing the Iago character. Josh Harnett, who like was really big for a little while, and then I haven't seen him in years. I think Channing Tatum like took his place at some point, but he is talking about power and all this kind of stuff, and they cut from all these white pigeons to this Dark Hawk, which is the mascot for the basketball team that they're on, and so much of the action takes place, you know, on the court, and then they have different, you know, parties and all this kind of stuff, and it was just really well done. I didn't think that they were going to be able to pull it off, but they pulled it off completely. But there were so many scenes, these love scenes with Mekhi Phifer and Julia Stiles, where it's close-ups, you know, of his black hand on her lily-white back and everything, and it's like, oh, this is really good. They're really playing up this whole interracial thing and the threat that he has, because I think he's one of the I think he might be the only black basketball player on this team. And then while I was doing research, I found another version of Othello, Dangerous Desire. And that one, I mentioned Joe D'Amato before. I always get him mixed up with Jess Franco for some reason, probably because of the quality of their work. He directed this hardcore pornography version of Othello. Horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Well, it just shows you, I mean, it's been done. I'm looking here at IMDb while we're talking. It's been done many, many times, you know, way back to the silent era. One of the funny things about Shakespeare is so popular that they did silent versions of his plays. And, you know, and we were talking about how Wells had made his Othello into a visual experience. And one thing Wells said once in defending his Shakespeare films against criticisms, like his Macbeth, for example, was viciously attacked in America. It's one of the reasons he left for Europe. His career, he couldn't get arrested as a director, too, as well as having political problems. But his Macbeth is very daring and I think a wonderful film, but it was made on real cheap sets for a low budget, and it's really a great achievement. But the critics were attacking that because it didn't have the kind of solemnity and the beautiful sets and the kind of prestige factor of Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, you know, which won the Best Picture Award in 1947, which is the kind of film the critics like because it seems more respectful of Shakespeare and all that, but it's relatively dull. And Wells's Macbeth is very flamboyant and very engrossing and very powerful, you know, in a visceral sense and also in poetic sense. And Othello is even more visual because he's not trapped in a soundstage. He's out there in Morocco and Italy, filming on locations and to some extent on a soundstage where Alexander Trauner, the great production designer, did some sets for him. But it's a freer film. And, you know, when I teach Wells, I talk about It's All True, his 1942 documentary in Brazil, where he left Hollywood to make this documentary with poor people in Brazil. And that's the start of his whole different style, where he's shooting on actual locations and he's working with some non-actors and some actors, and he's working without sound sometimes and using a lot of editing as instead of camera movement. And that culminates with Othello, and then some of the later films have that style too. But Wells broke free of the studio kind of mode of filmmaking, which he did so beautifully in Kane and Ambersons, but was denied to him later on. And he created this whole different style, and the critics didn't always like that because they don't always appreciate pure cinema. You know, they like things that are more like the stage or like a novel or something. And Wells said, for better or worse, my Shakespearean films should be seen as films, not as film plays. Although Macbeth is a kind of an interesting hybrid of theater and film, I think, because it's shot on a soundstage and it's very claustrophobic, but that's the nature of the play. Chimes of Midnight is a very kind of like a John Ford film. It's a sweeping epic film, but a lot of it takes place in the tavern, which is the big set that he had. You know, if you don't have a lot of money, put it all in one set. And but there's some tremendous battle scene, and there's a lot of great exteriors and things like that. So all three of his Shakespeare films are different in style, but use the medium very freely and flamboyantly, and that's not always to the liking of some people, but, you know, I think film buffs like it.
All right, we're going to take a break and play an interview with Samantha White, director of the Shakespeare in Detroit Company, after these brief messages.
The Anime Addicts Anonymous podcast presents Storytime with Cram.
And yes, we are now presently in Cram's house.
That's right.
So
we are in the murder room. Actually.
Yes, you know? This is the murder room.
Would you like to tell? You have to tell the story now.
I've told it on the podcast before, but I guess it was back in 2006, December of 2006. Someone was murdered in this house. The people that were living here. The son was taking care of his mother, and she was very ill, as I understand it. And I guess he wanted to put her out of her misery, so he took a pillow and asphyxiated her.
Right here.
Right where we're
same
doing
to
this.
Tommy?
Right here. Yeah, same to Tommy. Well, no, they changed the to Tommy.
Oh, they changed the
to
Tommy.
So you mean to tell me that we're actually broadcasting right now in the exact maybe square meter where a person was smothered to death?
Yeah.
Wow.
We're also underneath my bedroom where a man died of an illness.
Wow.
The father.
For more Anime Addicts Anonymous podcast, visit www.aaapodcast.com or iTunes.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
We interrupt our program with a special bulletin.
Okay, here we go. This is it.
Greetings and salutations.
Lesson! I'm Josh Gravel.
And I'm Scott LaFave.
Oh, good for you!
We want to let you know about the Arkham Film Society.
We're a small group of cinephiles programming classic, horror, cult, and exploitation film events in the Providence, Rhode Island area.
We have such sights to show you.
We try to meet a need for unconventional programming by providing affordable film events through our monthly screening series.
Be one of us.
Find us on Facebook and join our group by searching for the Arkham Film Society at facebook.com/Arkham Screening.
Join us.
Check out our blog at arkhamfilmsociety.blogspot.com.
And stop by our Etsy and buy stuff at etsy.com/people/Arkham Screening.
Yes, sir! You, sir! Right already, I'm hip!
We now return control of your television set to you.
My name is Samantha White, and I am the artistic director and founder of Shakespeare in Detroit.
So for those who aren't familiar with Shakespeare in Detroit, it sounds like a pretty simple title for an organization. What do you guys do?
Yeah, it's very specific. Yeah, it is. We perform in the places where people live, where they work, and where they play. So instead of people coming to us in a traditional theater, we come to them with performances and we interpret the space. So, for example, when we did Antony and Cleopatra, it was in a recycling center. So all of our costumes and set pieces were made from either recycled materials or repurposed materials.
Well, it sounds like a good way to do things, especially in Detroit when there are plenty of things around to use, I guess.
Yeah, we're trying to build a company, and I think the way to do that is to make it make sense for the people that we're trying to appeal to. So when you're going to the places that they're going to be anyway, you know, they're going to be at the park, they're going to recycle their things at a recycling center. And when you do that and you put a performance in the places where they go, it makes it easy for them to support. So we're trying to make theater that is as convenient for them as possible. And then they get there and they see what we're doing and they're entertained as well. So it's very cool.
Now, it says here on your Indiegogo page that the successful performance of Othello, Grand Circus Park, in August of 2013, would you consider that the beginning, or does it go back further than that?
I mean, it was the beginning for the other people involved and for the public who got to see the show. For me, the beginning was 2012. I'm a tech town entrepreneur, which means that I went through one of their programs and graduated from that program. So for me, it's been about 2 years because I graduated from Tech Town in May of 2012.
And for you, where did the idea come from? Why did you want to bring Shakespeare to the people of Detroit in the locations that you bring them? As you said, where they gather, where they congregate, as opposed to saying, hey, you know, come over to this theater and see the show.
Well, I was living in Vegas thinking that I was going to be a famous comedian one day, and someone happened to invite me, one of my friends in Vegas happened to invite me on a bus trip to Utah, and we went to Utah, Cedar City, to be specific, and we went to their Shakespeare Festival there. And when I got there, the first thing I thought was, if they can pull this off in the middle of the desert, then surely my hometown can have a Shakespeare company, because we have parks and all these really interesting historical venues and sites. And so after that, I decided I was going to come home and try to start a Shakespeare company. But I knew that because Shakespeare, or having a Shakespeare company in Detroit, had never been done before, I was going to have to do it in a way that maybe wasn't what a traditional theater company would do. And I needed to introduce the idea and the concept to people in a way that was easy for them to understand. Meaning, if I would have just started the theater company in a theater, I don't think it would have worked. I needed to go to those places where they congregate and where they go anyway, so that it was easy for them to have access to seeing our shows. And it was also important that the shows be free in the summer. That doesn't mean that all of our shows will be free, but when we kicked off the idea, they needed to be free because they needed to be as accessible as possible. So the venues being accessible, and then also people not having to break the bank when we introduced ourselves to them.
I was having a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Harry Lennox, who's an actor who's done a lot of Shakespeare, and we were talking to him about Titus, and one of the things that he said was, you know, folks who are, you know, multi-ethnic, we've got various backgrounds, and Detroit, very much a multi-ethnic city, a lot of African-Americans.
Yeah.
They don't want, you know, Shakespeare in their head. I mean, when people say Shakespeare to them, it's usually a bunch of British guys wearing tights, speaking in an arch manner in a language that doesn't really make it isn't as accessible as it is today. So his idea was to take it and to reintroduce it and say, we can have this. This can be something that can be of a broader appeal than just people who are interested in, oh, it's classical theater. And was just wondering, for you, how do you find it with Detroit when you bring, you know, this 400-year-old language, basically, and these plays? How has it worked? How have people engaged with it?
I think it's extremely important for the cast to be diverse. You can't ask for an audience that is multiracial or that has different experience and backgrounds if you're not representing that in your art. And so I'm committed to only doing shows that have a diverse group of actors. And also, I think because me myself, I'm obviously a Black artistic director. I think that has maybe kind of opened the door as well, because people think, you know, if this woman who graduated from Mumford High School and who graduated from Wayne State University and was born and raised on 7 Mile in Greenfield. If she can start a Shakespeare company, then let me give her a chance and come see what she's done with it. And then again, by me representing the city, because the city is a large melting pot with having actors who are white, black, and who have a wide variety of experience, because one of our actors, for example, Iago in Othello, that was his 25th Shakespeare play. And then our actress who played Cleopatra a few months ago, she had never done Shakespeare before. That was her first time doing it. So having people who have different kind of experiences with the Bard as well, I think opens it up to the audience, because we have some connoisseurs in our show. We have people who are experiencing it for the first time. It's important to reflect your audience. People, if you can't go to the theater and look at someone or hear someone say something that is something that you can relate to or parallel in your own life, you're not going to be interested. And that's the purpose of art anyway, right? So that we can go and feel something and take away something that we've experienced in our own lives. And so I think by us presenting the shows in a unique way and then having a diverse group of actors, and then also with me kind of being at the helm of it, I think that's why we've been embraced so well by the city.
So you're not only doing unique locations, you have, you know, a great mixed cast. The question then becomes the language itself, the stories. Does Shakespeare relate to the average experience of someone who's showing up now, even though the stuff was written 400 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, we all still get old. We all still get hungry. We all still want to be loved. We all need security. We all feel scared. You know, the clothes have changed. The technology has changed. The human experience hasn't. We've all been in love. We've all fell out of love. And that's what makes Shakespeare so relevant today. I was last weekend, I was walking around with the director of Romeo and Juliet, and we were on McNichols in Detroit, kind of just going from business to business, inviting people to our show. We did Romeo and Juliet at Mumford, and we were inviting people in the neighborhood to come. And there was a little baby in the in one of the barbershops that we went into, and I was kind of talking to him and playing with him. And I said, "Knock, knock, who's there?" And he responded. And that's because everybody knows that phrase, but everybody doesn't know that that phrase happens to be from Macbeth. So whether we realize it or not, Shakespeare is in our everyday lives. It's in our culture. It's embedded in us. And so now it's just become my responsibility to kind of show people that whether they know it or not, they're probably speaking Shakespeare, and they've had some engagement with him, whether they realized it or not.
As for yourself in this season, what you're trying to accomplish, can you give me an idea of some of the plays you plan to put on, maybe some of the places that you want to put them on?
Yeah, sure. I haven't really announced them, but people kind of know, because they're not a secret either. But we're doing the 10th in September. That's September 20th and 21st. It was our intention to do The Tempest on Belle Isle. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, because we haven't had as much support as I would have wanted for our Indiegogo campaign. In addition, the island is still kind of going through a lot of changes, now becoming a metro park. But we're going to do the show anyway. I'm looking right now at doing it at the YMCA Bowl in downtown Detroit. It'll be the first time that we've ever done theater in a theater, so that'll actually be kind of good for us, because for the first time we'll have restrooms and a dressing room and things like that. And then in April, we're going to be doing a residency at a local college. We're going to do a huge show. It's going to be King Lear. There will probably be about 40 to 60 actors in that show. It'll be my biggest show that I've produced to date. So we're really looking forward to that. And then in July, we're going to perform Macbeth at the Yamasaki Reflecting Pools. If people don't know where those are on Wayne State's campus at the McGregor Building. The Yamasaki Committee has asked us to bring a show to that space. If people don't know who Yamasaki is, Minoru Yamasaki designed buildings all over the world, including the World Trade Center. So it was an honor for them to commission a piece from Shakespeare in Detroit. So that's a little bit of what we're up to for 2014-15.
As for yourself, you talked about how you went out to Utah and you saw how this group was able to do that in the middle of the desert. But do you remember for yourself when you got interested in Shakespeare on the personal level?
Yeah, I was 8 years old, and I remember I was trying to listen to some rap song. It was either an N.W.A. song or Salt-N-Pepa or something. And we weren't allowed to listen to rap in my household. And so my mom caught me listening to, or she, I thought I was sneaking, but she heard me listening to some rap music in my room. And she knocked on the door and told me, okay, you're not supposed to be listening to that. You know that. And she went upstairs to her bedroom. And when she came down, she had the complete works of William Shakespeare. And she told me if I was so interested in lyrics, I would have to read this. And so I started reading it. I think I read A Midsummer Night's Dream first and a few other things. I didn't like it at first because I didn't understand it. But by the time I was in high school, I was pretty in love with Shakespeare. So that's where it started, me not being able to listen to rap.
So it started out as punishment.
It started out as a punishment, but it turned into something beautiful because if my mom didn't give me that book, I probably wouldn't have fallen in love with Shakespeare, and I certainly wouldn't have started a Shakespeare company. So I'm grateful for that punishment now. Now, at that time, I wasn't, but I appreciate it now.
Does she approve of you now doing what you do in terms of Shakespeare in Detroit?
Oh, she takes full credit. She takes full credit now. Maybe she saw something before I did, you know, and the potential to, I guess maybe she didn't see it as a theater company, but I guess expanding my horizons by giving me that book, because I haven't traveled a lot in my life, but reading, and especially reading Shakespeare, has taken me to a lot of places. So, yeah, she's very happy with what we've done, and she's seen all the shows, and she always tells me she's proud of me. So I'm happy that she gave me that book.
This is a film program that we do here, and we're looking at several Shakespeare films this month. And I was going to ask, is there a particular Shakespeare adaptation for film that you really like?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that, and I said, what film kind of played a role in the context of my journey with Shakespeare? And it's Othello. I saw Othello when I was 14 years old with Lawrence Fishburne. And at that time, I had never read Othello. I owned the complete works, but I had never read that one because I just loved reading kind of A Midsummer and Romeo and Juliet over and over again. But after I saw the film, I decided to actually read Othello. And that's because I didn't know at the time. I was kind of blown away by the fact that Othello was, I couldn't believe that Shakespeare had written a character that was a black character and a main character. And he wasn't it wasn't a small role. He was the role. He was playing Othello, and the name of the play was Othello. And so that kind of changed, I think, a bit of the trajectory of my life, because I chose Othello as our first show last year at Grand Circus Park.
Well, I think also maybe also being Detroiters, and we can talk amongst ourselves on this issue, the question of race within Othello, I think, might also play into the interest.
Sure, sure it does. And I think no one caught on to this except maybe me and my own consciousness, but I chose Othello not only because it resonated with me as a kid, and I knew that I wanted to do it because I wanted Detroiters to see that, yes, the main character happens to be a black man. But also at that time, the mayoral race was going on, and there was kind of this discomfort with one of the candidates, and people were kind of questioning his legitimacy. And I thought, wow, that really parallels Othello, because when he comes to Venice, people are kind of, you know, they respect him and he's valiant and he has this wonderful resume. But at the same time, everyone is aware of the fact that there's something different about him. And I felt like maybe that kind of was what was happening with one of our mayoral candidates. He had kind of a resume that was really robust, but people were kind of still questioning him. And I felt like he and Othello kind of shared that piece of the journey in common.
Is there anything about Shakespeare in Detroit that you want to add that maybe I forgot to ask about?
Yeah, I wanted to first of all just say thank you to everybody who has supported us, because we've had really, really large crowds. 300 to 800 people usually come to our shows, which is amazing for a young theater company. And so I'm really grateful for that. The only other thing that I would say is to please continue to support us, because even though we've had a lot of audience members and a lot of support and people who've shown up for us, these shows take a lot of effort. And so if people want to volunteer to help us, if they can sew, if they can build, if they want to donate, we could use all of that. And they could contact us by just shooting me an email. And I'm always the one answering at shakespeareindetroit@gmail.com.
And is there a website or any other way people can get in touch?
Oh, plenty of ways. We're very accessible. So they can go to ShakespeareInDetroit.com to sign up for updates. That way they'll always know which shows are coming up next. We'll shoot them audition notices, and they can always find out what's happening with Shakespeare in Detroit. They can also follow us on Twitter at ShakesInTheD. So that's Shakes, S-H-A-K-E-S, in the D. And then on Facebook at Shakespeare in Detroit. It's very easy to reach us. Very easy to find us.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
Back. Thanks to Samantha White for taking the time. I don't think any relation to you, right, Mr. White?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, you know, there's a lot of Whites out there. Well, we all have links over to where you can find out more about her work with Shakespeare in Detroit on our website, projection-booth.com. Now, Joseph, you had said earlier that there is a French Blu-ray of Othello coming down the pipe very soon, and just wanted to know, what can folks expect to find on that disc?
Well, Carlotta Films in France is releasing the Blu-ray and DVD versions of both Othello and Macbeth, Wells' 1948 film. The 1992 restoration, in quotation marks, which I have some issues with, is the Othello version, which has been spiffed up a bit visually, but it still has the same soundtrack. I did an interview with Robert Fisher, who's a very good documentary filmmaker who specializes in films about films and filmmakers, and he does a lot of great DVD extras and interviews, especially in Europe. He does other ones. He's working on Dead Pigeon on Beethoven Street now. The Sam Fuller film is being restored, and Fedora, the Billy Wilder film, he did a documentary on that. And he did a three-hour interview with me. I was in Berlin because this summer I was researching Ernst Lubitsch for a book that I'm working on that deals with Lubitsch. And I was at the Bundesarchiv watching films, and Robert lives in Munich, so he was going to interview me in California. But he said, well, if you're going to be in Berlin, I'll hop down there and do it. So we did this three-hour interview there, and then he cut it to 45 minutes, did a very good job, and intersperses some clips from the film and some stills and things. And so we covered a lot of ground, some of the things we're talking about today, but some other topics as well. And so I think that's a good extra. I'm not sure what other extras they might or might not have on the set. But if you, you know, it's good to have an all-region player if you can, if you're really a super film buff. There's certain films that only come out on home video in Europe, like, for example, Renoir's Day in the Country. I'm showing that in my film class in a couple weeks. And the only decent DVD you can get is from England, the British Film Institute. And it's beautiful. And, you know, so if you want to see that film, you need an all-region player. So it's worth the investment. It doesn't cost very much, actually, if you want to do that. So that is coming out in November. This will be a big time for Wells because his centenary is next year. He was born in 1915. So there are going to be a lot of festivals and conferences and things around the world. I'm going to be participating in some. And there are a couple of important books coming out on him. Young Orson, Pat McGilligan's biography of his life up to Citizen Kane, up to and including Citizen Kane, is going to be an important book that, you know, corrects a lot of myths and inaccuracies about Wells and turns up a lot of fresh information. Should be quite interesting. And Josh Karp is doing a book on The Other Side of the Wind, the still unfinished film that I was in for 6 years and which we started shooting in 1970, and it's still in the works. They're still trying to finish it. And Josh is doing a book that should be really a great read about the whole history of this troubled production. And he's interviewed everybody. He's found people that I've never even heard of to interview, and he's dug up all kinds of documents. And so at least those two books will be out, if not more. And so it should be quite a year for Wells fans next year.
Yeah, we actually talked to McGilligan. He's going to be on both of our In a Lonely Place and The Big Heat episodes.
Right.
And so he will be talking about the book on one of those. I'm not sure yet how that edit is going to go. And then, yeah, next year we're going to be doing a Other Side of the Wind episode. So we'll be talking to Josh about his book on that one, and hopefully talking to you too if you're up for it.
Yeah, I'm all psyched up for that one, and looking forward to it. There's so much to say about that film, and there's still a few people around who, most of the crew were young guys and one or two women, so a lot of them are around, although Gary Graber, the cameraman, unfortunately died, who was, you know, the most important person on the production after Wells. Most of the cast is gone. I'm one of the few surviving cast members because I was quite young at the time. So we have a lot of tales we can tell, and Josh has all kinds of information and tales, and that should be really an interesting show.
So getting back to Othello, what was really nice is that there is the documentary filming Othello that Wells made with Graver, and that helps to kind of shed some light on the production. Just to say again, this thing took 4 years to shoot, and it wasn't all in a row. It wasn't like Waterworld or something. There was definitely a lot of breaks going on in there. And this whole idea of them ramping up and not having stuff, and, you know, the famous story about the Turkish bath is one that I think I read about that in This Is Orson Welles the first time, and then ever since then it's kind of one of those tales that gets told. So the brief version of it is that when they finally went to shoot, they didn't have their costumes ready, or the costumes didn't arrive, so they decided to shoot the murder of Michael Cassio in a Turkish bath, quote unquote, even though it was actually not a Turkish bath, but they made it look like that. So they had the actors, but they didn't have the outfits. So what are they going to do? They're either going to let them run around naked, or they're going to put them in towels and pretend that it's a Turkish bath. And it becomes one of the, really, to me, one of the kind of standout scenes in the film. And it was amazing to see that, again, that the way that the limitations helped spur the creativity. So it was really nice.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I'll just correct. Actually, Roderigo gets killed there. Cassio is the intended victim, but Roderigo is this pathetic character who gets killed. And actually, the story, Wells always said, you know, I had this brilliant idea of doing it with actors with no clothes on and just towels and all that. But it's now said that Alexander Trauner had the idea for that scene, who is the art director. So, you know, with Wells, sometimes the myths are more complicated. But it's a brilliant sequence. And, I mean, it's once you see it, you think, you know, it shouldn't be played any other way. It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of the either frustrating or fun things about Wells, is that you never know what version of the story you're going to get.
Yeah, one thing Pat McGilligan has mentioned is that he's finding out a lot of the stories about Wells' youth aren't true, but actually Wells told the truth more often than people think. It's kind of fashionable to say that Wells made up a lot of lies and told all kinds of stories, but actually a lot more of his stories apparently are true but you have to check them out. That's what film historians do. But Wells's life was so colorful and lurid that, you know, a lot of things that seem bizarre actually happened. I'll mention something about filming Othello, and it's frustrating. Filming Othello is not on this DVD set and is not available in America, except I believe you can see it on YouTube. The problem with that film was it was made for German television in the 70s, and it's sort of in limbo because Oya Kodar, who is Wells' partner, she inherited his rights to a lot of his work, except for the film Othello, which was inherited by his daughter Beatrice, and Beatrice does not like Oya, to put it mildly, and there's an enmity between them, and so they can't release filming Othello without Beatrice's approval to use the clips, which means that the film is not released, can't be shown. And so it's very hard for people to get a hold of, a copy. And, I have some copies from long ago, but it's never been officially released on home video, but copies pop up on the internet. So it's worth watching. It's a strange film because Wells is sitting at a Steinbeck, and he says it's a movie all of it, it's a Steinbeck, and he's talking about Othello, and he's showing clips from it, which he's re-edited a lot, which is kind of funny, I mean, in light of all these controversies about re-editing, he's re-editing his own film again, which he loved to do, and he's giving his thoughts on one thing or another. But when I first saw it, I was kind of disappointed, because I thought I wanted to hear his take on why he did it and what he thought the film was about and all that. But he's quoting from a critic named Jack Jorgens, who wrote a book on Shakespeare and film. And he says at the beginning that, you know, I don't think a director should talk about his intentions, or an artist shouldn't talk about his intentions, because he said that's not really what matters in a work of art. It's what you think. And he said, I have certain opinions about the film, which I'm not going to tell you. So instead, he's quoting from this other guy all through the film about his own film, which is kind of strange. But now I kind of respect that, because I experienced that with John Ford when I interviewed him when I was 23. I was very disappointed that Ford really wouldn't talk about his work very much, wouldn't give you much of a response. And now I really respect that, because Ford was basically saying, you know, the films should speak for themselves, and I'm not going to just sit here and explain it for you. And today when a film comes out, the director is on every talk show and gives interviews in the press, and you get tired of hearing the director explaining how you're supposed to watch the film. And I would prefer just to make up my own mind about how what I think about a film. And so I kind of respect the directors who don't do that. But here is Wells spouting off this other guy's thoughts, but it's very well put. Jack Jorgens does an excellent interpretation of it, and you know, after a while, you can't quite tell, is Wells quoting Jorgens or is he actually saying this stuff himself? The line gets blurred, but Jorgens basically is talking about the film as showing the disintegration of an entire world. It's not just about an individual psyche disintegrating. It's the visual style shows the whole world in collapse, and all the Baroque nature of it, and the highly fragmented cutting, and the disorientation of cutting from one country to another, and like Rob was talking about, the extreme low angles. Sometimes you don't know where you are, or you know what you're supposed to be looking at, or you know the angles vary so much. Jorgens says that's the point of the film, is to show a world out of whack or out of control, and that's very powerful in the film, and Wells more or less endorses that in filming Othello. So it's worth watching if you can find it on YouTube.
The other thing that I found interesting in watching that is it almost seems in style at points a companion piece to F for Fake, because you have him behind the editing machines there and sort of talking to you as he's looking at these clips and all this stuff. So in terms of style, it almost seems like a sister piece.
Yeah, I have a couple of funny stories. Wells was going to do a whole series of films about his own films. He thought he'd invented a new kind of film, is the way he put it, with F for Fake. And he called it the essay film, and that's a brilliant film. And he was going to do a whole series of them because, you know, they were cheap to make, and he could, you know, he wasn't very mobile at that point. He had trouble walking, et cetera, so he could just sit there and talk, and he was a great talker. But F for Fake, you know, nobody went to see it, unfortunately, and so filming Othello was the only essay film he completed after that, although he started filming The Trial, a film called Filming the Trial, and he shot a 90-minute discussion with an audience at USC, and I was part of that, and but he never integrated that with any film footage or anything, but the Munich Film Museum has restored that, and that can be seen, and it's a very good discussion. But he was going to do Lady from Shanghai. He said he wasn't going to do it based on what he thought were his best films, but the ones that had the most interesting stories connected to them. And Othello certainly had interesting stories, and Lady from Shanghai did. But there's a funny thing in filming Othello, when we were talking about the incongruity of the editing of close-ups, that long discussion with Wells, McLemore, and Edwards in a hotel room in Paris, they're all sitting there having a chat, very interesting chat, and Wells's close-ups don't match. If you look at it, the color is, you know, it's a different film stock. I asked Gary Graver, the cinematographer, why that was the case. You can tell that Wells shot his close-ups at a different time, and he liked to do that because he could then, you know, just write what he was going to say and then stick it in the scene, and it gave him a certain control over the thing that the people who were being interviewed didn't have, you know. But it's very jarring. And I said to Gary, why did that happen? He said, well, I wanted, he said, I tried to get Orson to shoot the close-ups at the same time as we were doing McLeamore and Edwards, and Orson said, no, we'll do them later, we'll do them later. And he said, well, can we just, you know, after they leave, just sit there and you can do your close-ups. He said, no, we'll do them. So 3 years went by, and Gary said they couldn't get the same film stock. It wasn't being manufactured anymore. So it bothered Gary as a cinematographer that it's obviously shot at different times. But I think in a weird way, Wells liked that kind of incongruity. He liked us to notice that the artifice of it, and Efferfake is full of that, that he's showing us how films are edited literally in that film. He sits there at his Steenbeck and shows you how he's editing footage and creating fabricated versions of things. And the film Othello is stitched together of many, many hundreds of shots, and you're very conscious of the fabrication and the presence of the filmmaker. And I think in filming Othello, he's demonstrating that. And I don't think he would particularly mind that the shots don't match.
He's violating the 180-degree rule in a lot of those, where he should be sitting across from Hilton and McLeamore. Instead, he's sitting almost next to them at the table and doesn't match their eye lines whatsoever. So it was interesting. And then I did like that they kind of ended that sequence with him back at the Steenbeck and the film running out on the editing machine and everything. So that was kind of a nice way to end it. McLeamore, he's an interesting cat. I would love to read his book. Right now it's out of print as far as I know, and very pricey on Amazon, so I was not able to put my hands on a copy. But I did find a BBC version of it where it was cut down to an hour, and it was done very much like a radio play. And it's Simon Callow, who has written about Wells, if I'm not mistaken, a few times now.
Yeah, he's written two volumes of biography of Wells. He's working on the third and final volume. He's a major biographer of Wells.
He does a spot on McLeamore impersonation. He is just dead right with it. The guy who does the Wells voice, he's no Pinky from Pinky and the Brain, or he's no The Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Welcome, dear friend. Welcome.
Now, you know, I was beginning to wonder if this day would ever come to pass.
Then wonder no more. Hey, what's this? What? I swear you put on 6 pounds.
No.
God damn it, everyone! I engaged this man to play Iago, and he arrives, no waddles into town, fully half a stone heavier than when I last saw him.
I blame your friends at the Villa Bataille.
No excuses, Michael. Tonight and every night, I prescribe a plate of eggs, fish, and raw tomatoes until you're fit for your tunic.
Well, now, Austin, when do we start filming?
Very soon. Mugador has enough towers, bastions, bells, and dungeons to pass for Cyprus.
But it was very well put together, and it was from McLeamore's point of view. So this whole idea of hurrying up and waiting, and just the frustration of traveling around Europe, and nobody knows where Orson is a lot of the times, and Rita Hayworth will make little appearances here and there, and just Wells trying to, a lot of it was the struggle of Wells trying to get the right actress to be Desdemona. And that's one thing you touched on briefly, is the whole idea of the recasting of these people while the film is being done was another challenge that they had to face.
McLeamore also did an autobiography called All for Hecuba, and one of the most interesting things he wrote about Wells, he describes Wells's audition at the Gate Theater when Wells was 16, and he came there and he pretended he was a star on the Broadway stage, and he claimed he fooled Edwards and McLeamore into hiring him, and they later said they didn't believe him for a minute because he seemed very amateurish in a way, but he had such tremendous force and power, they hired him. And anyway, I saw a British television interview with Wells where they read that description by McLeamore of that audition, and they said, what do you think of that? And he said, well, it's wonderful. Wells said it's wonderful and it's fascinating, especially since the man who wrote it was in London at the time, you know. So you can't always believe McLeamore. One thing about him that's very nice is Curtis Harrington, who is a fine American director who made avant-garde films, and then he was relegated to making cheap horror films, but made very stylish ones, was a Wells fan, and he was in The Other Side of the Wind, and he hired McLemore, brought him to Hollywood. It's the only time I think McLemore was ever hired for a Hollywood film. What's the Matter with Helen? He has a very juicy part in that. If people want to see that, it's a film with Shelley Winters, and it's fascinating to see Michael McLemore in a big Hollywood film. He was a really underused actor when you consider how good he is. But he was mainly a stage actor, and Edwards was a famous stage director, and they were a team, and that was their great passion. And one of the problems that they had making the film of Othello is that they had to keep going back. They had, you know, a season to do in Dublin, and they had to postpone some of their plays and things like this. It caused them immense problems. When you're running a theater company, you can't just drop everything and go off and make a film as Wells expected them to do. And it you know, I mean, their loyalties were divided to Wells, but they actually would postpone sometimes their entire season so they could go off to Morocco and work on Othello.
So people in Detroit will have a chance to see the restored Othello, restored in quotation marks, Othello, the 2014 version, and whatever that brings to us. It'll be playing at the Detroit Film Theater on November 15th, 2014. I don't have the time, unfortunately, for some reason. The DIA's website doesn't have the time listed. I'm thinking it'll probably be a 2 or 3 o'clock show, but we will be posting more about that over at our Facebook group when the details come apparent. So let's go ahead and take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
Help you.
Yeah. I need 3 boxes of a dozen Trojans, 1 regular, 1 ripped, and 1 lubricated. Mm-hmm. A sanitary sponge, 1 KY jelly, 1 Caramex contraceptive cream, and an herbal douche. Oh, and can you fill this prescription for low over 21?
You don't take any chances, do you?
Working Girls, the highly acclaimed new feature film by Lizzie Borden from Miramax Films.
That's right. This marks the final week of our Shakespeare September celebration, and we'll be back to regular programming, well, at least as regular as we can be for us next week, as we talk about Lizzie Borden's film about the life of prostitutes in a New York brothel, Working Girls. And we'll be touching off on another theme month soon, so get ready for November Noir, just a few weeks from now. So I want to thank our special guest, Samantha White, for coming on and talking about Shakespeare in Detroit, and also Joseph McBride for coming on the show. Now, Joseph, you were on our Magnificent Ambersons and also Executive Action episodes, and was just wondering, what is the latest with you, sir?
Well, I'm working, teaching at San Francisco State, as always, and writing a book that deals with Ernst Lubitsch, the great German-American director who's always been a favorite of mine, and I've been researching this for several years. One of the challenges of doing his work is a lot of it is not available in the U.S., and so I had to go to Germany and Switzerland to see a lot of the films. So I've now seen everything that exists of Lubitsch, and it's a great treat and thrill to be able to do that. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, or am writing the book. So I'm working on the writing of it now and researching his life in Germany and German film culture, and then his coming to America. It's a great career, which I think is underappreciated today. A lot of people today, you mentioned his name, they don't know who that is, and that's probably why I'm writing this book, I think, because when I started writing on John Ford back in the 60s, I'd have that reaction. I'd say, John Ford is my favorite director, and I'd get these blank stares, which was really disheartening. And today, you don't get that reaction. People know who he is now that enough has been written about him, and his films are shown a lot. But Lubitsch, you get that blank stare, so I'm hoping to reverse that. So that's one of the things I'm working on. And I did the audio commentary on My Darling Clementine, the John Ford film, for Criterion is coming out next month, October, with a beautiful Blu-ray edition of Clementine looks really spectacular, and I did the commentary on that. And I'm in, I think, 5 documentaries on Wells that are coming out, including the Robert Fisher one I mentioned. Also, Magician, the Chuck Workman film, is just coming out, and a couple of French documentaries and some other ones, and, you know, so a lot of different things.
Very cool. It sounds like you're definitely keeping busy.
Yeah. It's a busy life, but it's fun when you get these opportunities as a film scholar. That's what it's part of the treat is, you know, I spent all these years thinking, why can't I see these Lubitsch films? And then, okay, well, I'm going to have to cook up a project so I can go to Germany and see them.
But that means that you probably don't get a whole lot of time to go out to the theater, you know, and see like Blended or Jack and Jill or any of those.
Well, I do, yeah. When you're a film scholar, and like if you're, say, doing My Darling Clementine, I had to bone up again on Wyatt Earp and all that. And I read several books on Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and watched the film several times. And so you're living in the past to some extent, which is fine with me. I love the past, as the character in Max Ophüls' Laurent says. It's more restful than the present and more certain than the future, he says. But I do try to keep up with the important films that are coming out, and I'm a member of the American Cinema Editors and the Writers Guild, so I get the DVDs at the end of the year, and I can catch up on some things that I've missed when the award season rolls by.
Well, something tells me that Blended won't be amongst those films, but you never know. Well, thanks again, Joseph, for coming on. We'll have links for folks to go over and check out Joseph's many books, as well as other fun stuff at our website, projection-booth.com. We'll also have a link over there to go to our iTunes page where people can leave reviews. Even if you don't listen to the Projection Booth with iTunes, those reviews mean a lot. So go ahead, give us some stars. It'll just make you feel better.
Don't you feel like trying something new? Don't you feel like breaking out or breaking us in two? You don't do the things that I do. You wanna do things I can't do. Always something breaking us in two. You and I could never. Don't you feel like breaking out just one day on your own? Why does what I'm saying hurt you? I didn't say that we were through. Always something breaking us in two. Cause it's oh so hard to do. Could we be much closer if we tried? We could stay at home and stare into each other. Some